Brigham is a complex man in our sense, but wow, what capacity he had. I remember reading a book by Irving Stone, but I remember him making a comment about Brigham Young. And he said, you know, people have faulted Brigham Young because he became wealthy. He said, he was so talented. He couldn't have avoided being wealthy because he was just so good. And he said, you know, if he had not been a Latter-day Saint, he could have succeeded almost anywhere in the country. He was that good. And he thought he was maybe the single most important person in the colonization of the American West.
Welcome to Conversations with Interpreter. I'm Avram Shannon.
And I'm Fora Shannon.
Today we're talking with Dan Peterson about the new web series, Becoming Brigham. Daniel C. Peterson is a professor emeritus of Islamic studies and Arabic at Brigham University, where he founded the university's Middle East Text Initiative. He has published and spoken extensively in both Islamic and Latter-day Saint subjects. And when we say extensively, we mean extensively. He formerly chairman of the board for the Foundation of Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, the Old Farms, and an officer, editor, and author for successor organization, the Neil A. Maxwell Institute for the Scholarship. Professional work is an Arabist focused on the Quran and Islamic philosophical theology. He's the author, among other things, of a biography called Muhammad, and it'd be fun to talk about that. But today we're talking about another prophet, we're going to talk about Brigham Young. So this new series, Becoming Brigham, Dan, can you tell us what is it?
Yeah, it's, well, we did a film in 2021 called Witnesses, about the witnesses to the Book of Mormon. And then we did a documentary afterwards called Undaunted, Witnesses of the Book of Mormon. And, you know, we were pleased with it and displeased with it in some ways. Documentaries just don't move as well as theatrical films do. And you don't make any money from it. It's not like we're in it to make money, but you kind of like to get your money back.
Yeah, at least enough to, you know, break even.
Yeah. And so we just decided, look, on this next one, we did then a movie called 6 Days in August. Basically focused on the rise of the 12 to leadership in the church.
Okay.
The succession crisis in 1844 after the death of Joseph and Hiram. And then we said, well, should we do another documentary? Well, we said, let's just forget about the idea of making any money back from it. Let's just assume upfront we're not going to. We're just going to make it as available as we can for nothing, no charge, no monetization. So I've always told people when they donate money to support it, this is not an investment. You will never see that dollar again, you know?
Not a financial investment.
Right. I mean, we hope there'll be some other rewards, but if any money does come back in, it's going to be plowed into the next project. I mean, you might call it the perpetual cinematic fund or something like that, you know. So we decided that we do these short mini documentaries.
Okay.
And just put them up online and get them as widely distributed as we can. They're going to range probably mostly between 12 and 15 minutes. There'll be, we thought initially, 52 of them. So we thought a year, every week. Now it looks like there'll be about 75.
Okay.
And which is a good problem, but a bad problem nonetheless. I mean, I have to raise the money to support it. But we've had remarkable cooperation from the Church History Department up in Salt Lake
and
from other scholars. And especially the church history people have been pushing additional historians toward us and saying, hey, you ought to talk about this, you ought to talk about that, which has lengthened the thing out. And then when we do the interviews, there's a lot of interviews. Sometimes I've been saying to Mark Goodman, who writes the scripts, roughly, we kind of ad lib, but the talking points that we want to cover in any given episode. And I've told Mark, good luck getting this down into one episode because there's so much good stuff. I mean, look, I'm fairly well informed on Latter-day Saint history and things like
that. Yeah.
But I'm learning new things when I interview these scholars because we've got people who are doing cutting edge research.
Yeah.
And so when they're talking to us about relations with Native Americans, for example, in Utah, I don't know anything about that.
Sure.
And so it's just really eye-opening to me, but really good perspectives. And so the idea behind this is to look at Brigham Young, the rise of the 12. We talk about his conversion, which is not as rapid as a lot of people think. It took him a while. Yeah, once he was in, he was all in, but it took him a while.
I will sometimes use that with my students at BYU to say, you know, even Brigham Young guys had to think about this a little bit.
That's right, he did. He wanted to know if there was sound common sense manifest among these people. He didn't want to get in with a bunch of loons. I can understand that. And there probably were a few loons associated with this. There typically have been. But we talk about his conversion. We talk about his call to the 12, the formative experiences that made him what he was. And an important issue, the rise of the 12 to leadership, because originally it was a missionary quorum.
Right.
Focused on, you know, external things, not running the church internally. He had the High Council for that. There was just one at first. And then gradually, but importantly, during Joseph Smith's lifetime,
yes,
it begins to assume responsibility for things within the church. That's clearly something that Joseph has in mind.
Yeah.
And so our contention would be in 1844, they were the logical successors for a whole lot of reasons. They'd been prepared for it. I don't know if they recognized that, but they had been,
yeah,
given the responsibilities they had and the way Joseph was moving things around in the quorums and Sidney Rigdon's partial disaffection. And there were just a lot of things that went into that. But then afterwards, we want to address, as far as we can uncover them, and I'm inviting people, send in questions about Brigham Young,
okay, yeah,
objections, and we'll try to address them. So we're going to address things like Brigham Young and violence, Brigham Young and women, Brigham Young and race, you know, Brigham Young, was he really an oppressive autocrat? Things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had a question about this.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Brigham Young was president for so long,
oh, yeah,
right? Like the longest of anyone. How are you deciding, even with, you know, now this expanded format of 75 episodes, how are you deciding what to focus on? Because there's just so much information.
There is. And I mean, we could get lost. I mean, and I'm told, we've talked to people in the historical department about doing the Brigham Young papers, not that we would, but the
Yeah.
But there are so many Brigham Young papers.
Garrett Dirkmott once told me, we're in a meeting on campus, and he's like, the thing is that people talk about this, and he's like, Brigham Young's letters. He's like, just his letters, Garrett told me, he said, are larger than the entire Joe Smith Papers project.
Yeah. So, it's huge. So I don't know that can be done, or if it did, it would take decades.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure anyone would have the patience to wade through it all, and it's just so much. But on the other hand, there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, the historical department at one point said, look, here's something you ought to do. They've got a couple of historians who are working on a 2-volume collection of Brigham's letters to ordinary saints. And they said, we think this would give you a different perspective. Would you be interested? And I said, absolutely. That's the kind of thing I want to do, because it's one thing to know Brigham as this guy thundering from the pulpit.
Right.
But then the guy writing letters to the individual Latter-day Saint in Parowan or something, you know, and trying to help with a problem, you see a pastoral side to him that it will maybe surprise a lot of people. And so I leaped at the chance, said, yeah, absolutely, we want to do that. But there's almost no end to subjects and no end to the details you could get into. So we'll do, my bet is it won't be one episode, but it might be 2 or 3 on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, for
sure,
example. But my word, volumes and volumes have been written on that. So all we can do is I don't say skim the surface. I hope we'll get to the essential issues. And then maybe one of the things we're going to do is then put up lists of further recommended readings. You want to go deeper into this. And we're also, just talked about it this morning, we're going to take the interviews that we've done. Where, you know, you interview an academic for 2 or 3 hours, and at the end you use 5 minutes, 10 minutes of what he or she said. Well, we want to put the transcript and the audio, at least, of the entire interviews up.
That would be different.
Yeah, I think, you know, not everybody will be interested in that, but some fellow academics, historians, would love to hear Professor so-and-so talk for 3 hours about, you know, Native American affairs in Utah. If that's your interest, we're going to put the whole thing up there. So.
Well, and that's a way to balance the very limit that you can't do everything in your video,
right,
with also that people really have this thirst for knowledge, and being able to access that is really helpful for you to facilitate that access.
Yeah, and I just thought, listening to the interviews, I've conducted a lot of them, not all of them, but I thought, oh, wow, that was good stuff, and I know we can't use most of it. We just can't. But I hate to have it lost. It's a resource. You know, how often do you get someone like that sitting down doing really serious discussion of his or her specialty field on tape? So let's put that somewhere where it's accessible.
Oh, that's great. So thinking about that, because again, you kind of alluded to this already here with some of this stuff. Outside the church, certainly, but sometimes even in the church, mm-hmm, Brigham Young can sometimes be an ambivalent figure.
Yeah.
Right? Like you talk about, you know, have experience where, you know, you use a Brigham Young quote and somebody will say like, well, you know, that's just Brigham Young.
Yeah.
Right. So just think about this so why do you think he sometimes has an ambivalent reputation, even in the church sometimes?
Yeah. You know, partly we do have so much from him. I mean, so many sermons.
Yeah.
I mean, if we'd gotten everything Isaiah ever said over the course of his lifetime, I bet from time to time he would say some things where you'd be scratching your head or thinking, well, that was kind of crude or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so you get
that. We have so much. The Journal of Discourses are behind us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's like transcripts, or not even transcripts, but like somebody's notes on it.
Yeah.
So many. Yeah, exactly. That.
Well, and we have just put up an episode, our episode number 2, which is an interview, partially at least, with Lejean Carruth.
Oh, yeah.
Who's done all the work on Pittman, 19th century Pittman shorthand.
Oh, yeah.
And I asked her once, so Lejean, what is the biggest misrepresentation of Brigham Young? And she said, the Journal of Discourses.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's joking a little bit, but not entirely, because she'll make the point, and she makes it in our interview, that George D. Watt, who did it, systematically, for reasons that elude me, whenever he had a choice, he made Brigham look tougher, meaner, more autocratic, a little more arrogant than his own Pittman shorthand shows him to be. And she gives specific examples. And she says, you know, when you spend time with his real words, he's a nicer man. He's a kinder, more gentle man. But Watt seemed to, I don't know, maybe, I have no idea why he did it. But
he's less pithy. Like,
yeah.
Like, George D. Brigham is very pithy, right?
Yes.
Emily quotable, but.
Oh, yeah.
But also, again, I've seen some of the work that she's done, and you read the actual statement, like, oh, okay, he's a lot more rambly in his speech than he's presented here.
Yeah, and also I've wondered sometimes with some of the things he says, oh, I think he could be tough. He was blunt.
Yeah,
I've wondered sometimes, could Joseph Smith have led the Saints out west? Joseph gave everything away in his store in Nauvoo.
Yes.
About the only criticism you ever get from Brigham Young about him was he was a terrible shopkeeper. Well, Brigham Young was not like that.
No.
He would make sure that people did what they were supposed to do. But I've sometimes wondered if you could hear his voice, if you could see maybe a twinkle in his eye, some of the things he's saying, I suspect, they look different on the printed page. I mean, I know with friends, I'll sometimes, we greet each other with a round of kind of insults.
Sure.
But we've known each other for decades, and they're not really meant, but someone just reading out of the page would say, they're about to beat each other up. You have to have been there in a way. But I know he had a sense of humor. Mark Twain commented on it, and Mark Twain knew a sense of humor when he saw one. But, you know, there's a wonderful scene that I've always loved where a woman comes to Brigham Young's office and says, Brother Brigham, my husband is really rough on me verbally. He didn't use the term, she didn't, but we'd say verbally abusive.
Sure.
And he says, well, like what? And she says, well, the other day he told me to go to hell. What should I do? And he paused and said, well, sister, don't go. And I think there's a lot of that there.
Yeah,
and we've kind of lost that sense of Brigham Young. Because a lot of people, there were people who didn't like him, including some members of the church at the time.
Sure.
Because he was a forceful personality. And
I mean,
didn't always.
It even worked together. I mean, you know, of course, him and Orson Pratt had longstanding, we'll say, conversations.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they were tough.
They were.
But, you know, even Brigham Young would say afterwards, well, if you cut Orson into little pieces, every part of him would scream out, Mormonism is true.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, exactly.
He recognized that. But I think the saints then knew him. They knew that he was given to a hyperbole. They were used to it. And I don't think most of them took it that seriously. Oh, they knew he was serious when he's telling him to do things. But they weren't offended. And we read it now and think, how could he have said such a thing?
I think that's key. The notion that they knew him. One thing it's worth remembering, you know, in our large church where most of us are at most going to shake an apostle's hand, right? You know,
yeah.
Most people in the church, you know, we're very distant from that.
Yeah.
It's just so big now.
Right.
Right. But of course, in those days, it was much smaller.
Yeah.
And so the 12 were, and Brigham Young in particular, were with them in a way that it's hard for us to think about in the church today.
Yeah, I think that's a real problem. And so, and also, frankly, it was the 19th century American frontier. Brigham Young was born in 1801. He's not going to have exactly the same sensibilities that we do. It's just not possible. I mean, you hear the term presentism. That's really true in his case, that you can't judge him. I mean, obviously, there's some things you can. There are moral truths that are always so. But mannerisms, temperament, modes of expression, they've changed a lot since then. And they would say some things that where we just cringe, and they didn't.
So are you guys going to go over, I know you talked about Mountain Meadow Massacre. Are you going to talk about some other possibly sensitive subjects like blacks in the priesthood?
Oh, yes.
And, you know, I can't think of the other one I was just thinking of, but that one's plenty. So
yeah,
that's a big one, and there's a lot to say on that. In fact, Just today, I ran across a statement, well, in two different places where they said, well, Brigham Young endorsed slavery. And I used to think that was true. I remember learning about an 1852 slave bill that was passed by the legislature, the territorial legislature, and I thought, oh, that's embarrassing. That's not his finest hour. Brigham Young, the man, not Brigham Young, the prophet. And then some books have begun to come out about slavery in Utah Territory and black issues in Utah Territory. It turns out I was completely wrong, and almost everything people say about that bill is wrong. Brigham Young explicitly said he disliked slavery. It was wrong. You can't own human flesh. And what he wanted was a bill on what he called servitude. Well, indentured servitude was a thing in the early 19th century. In fact, Brigham probably served as an indentured servant himself. That's how you often learned your trade. You know, were apprenticed to a carpenter or a cooper or something like that. So they were all used to what we would now call unfree labor. But it wasn't slavery. And so what he tried to institute in that bill, people were coming into Utah Territory with black slaves.
Right.
And the question was how to deal with this. We can't just go and seize what they regard as their property. We'd get resistance. I mean, we don't want violence. And I mean, look what happened a few years later.
Right. I mean, yeah.
750,000 people died in that war. So it was a serious thing. Sure. Let's not have strife. But is there a way we can limit it? Is there a way we can put an end to it gradually, gradual emancipation? And that's what they were trying to do in that bill, that, for example, a servant, as they called him, could not pass his or her status on to a child.
Okay.
So multi-generation chattel slavery, as in the South, was not possible under that law. Every servant had a right to so many months of education per year. Probably, I'm guessing, about as much as the typical white guy on the American frontier got. They had legal status. They could sue their masters if they were mistreated. Just a lot of things like that. And the bill even says they have a right to wholesome recreation. I think that's actually the phrase that's used. Now, that was not a big thing on plantations, slave plantations in the South. So I gave a presentation on this at the Fair Symposium in August. And I said, look, Brigham said some things about race that make us cringe. They're embarrassing. I wish he hadn't said them. I'm going to give you a long quotation. I read a quotation about blacks shouldn't have the same status as whites. They shouldn't rule over whites, et cetera, et cetera. They're not equipped for that sort of thing. And it's kind of embarrassing by our standards. But then I said, but you know what? That's not from Brigham Young. That's from Abraham Lincoln. And so, you know, that was the attitude among even what you might call, don't you want to use the word progressive.
For those who were moving towards equaler rights for whites and blacks in the period.
Yeah, and they would say, slavery is wrong, but I don't want a black guy to marry my daughter.
Right.
Or I don't think he ought to be a member of the Senate or something like that. And I would say in their defense, it's a weak defense, but well, it's still a bit of a defense. I would say, look, the black people you would have met would have been menial laborers for the most part, probably illiterate, because it was against the law to teach them to read and write in the South. And, you know, just not the kind of person you'd want to bring into the highest reaches of society at this point. Now, the problem with some was they thought that was just incapacity.
Right.
I think, no, it's just lack of opportunity. But you looked at it and you thought, these are not society's elite. Well, they certainly weren't.
But they couldn't be.
Yeah, they couldn't.
The American whatever had prevented them from doing anything with that.
Yes. Yeah. So, but I've discovered some nice things. I remember... I was about to get up and speak at Fair, and Mark Ashurst McGee, an LDS historian, was sitting next to me. He said, have you ever heard this story? And he told me a little story that I liked so much, I immediately put into my remarks there when I got up. And there are actually two parts. I used one, didn't use the other. He was referring to Elizabeth Kane, who was the wife of Thomas Kane, Colonel Kane, the famous friend of the Mormons.
Yeah.
Who was an abolitionist, you know, from Philadelphia. And I think he was probably a little more progressive. I get the impression his wife may not have been quite so open-minded as he was, because there are two things from one of her visits that she mentions in a letter. She says, they came out, Thomas was a little bit ill, and Brigham said, hey, I'm going down to southern Utah for the winter. Why don't you come with me? The air will do you good. And so they come along. And she's offended because one of Brigham's drovers, is suffering from arthritis and rheumatism, whatever else. His joints were just in pain. And so they decided to empty out one of the wagons, build a bed for him, put in pillows and everything, put him in the back. I'm sure it was still miserable bouncing.
Sure, no kidding.
But better probably than out on the wagon. And Elizabeth Kane was offended by this because, you know, she didn't think black people ought to be treated that way. And these Mormon elders are giving him a bed and a wagon, let him, you know, just go along in leisure. And then the one that really bothered her, and this is the one that I incorporated into my talk, she comes around a corner in a place where they're lodging en route to St. George. And there she sees this man. It's Isaac James, I think the husband, or by this time former husband, Jane Manning James.
Yeah.
And he's trying to put on his coat. He can't move his arms quite. And so she comes around the corner and she says, "There I saw Brigham Young, the Pope of the Mormons," that's what she calls him, "helping this man on with his coat." And she says, and he, James, was not showing the proper deference, you know, gratitude that a man of his status should be paying to a white man. I like that scene because here's Brigham, you know, who's been dismissed as a racist, a horrible person there, right?
Yeah.
Helping this slightly disabled black guy on with his coat. That's a really nice human touch.
Yeah.
He's not doing it for an audience, but she's offended. Yeah. She, the wife of the prominent abolitionist, is offended at that. Well, that's the kind of thing I think people need to hear more about Brigham.
I think so. You just said, you know, dismissed, right? And I think part of the whole thing is that Brigham Young looms really large. We talked about that. He's a big guy. He did a lot of things over his lengthy career in the church, now the church. And there's this desire sometimes, I think, to just dismiss him.
Yeah.
Right? To say, if we can find a way to label him, we have to deal with the fact that, you know, I remember reading Anne. I didn't read much of it, but John Turner's biography and things. And my point is that, like, but you never answer the question, why did people follow this guy?
Yeah, and that's an issue. But a lot of them loved him. He was Brother Brigham. They didn't fear him or hate him. He was highly thought of, their esteemed leader. I mean, if someone like Green Flake, there's another story. Green Flake was a black slave. At one point, Brigham Young bought him and then freed him and gave him a farm in the south end of the Salt Lake Valley and said, "It's yours. Go ahead and marry." He married a black woman, a fellow former slave. And that is not what you'd expect from Brigham. But then at one point, Green Flake comes to Brigham and says, "You know, I'm still struggling with this farm because I've got to give a lot of the produce to my wife's ex-master to pay off her freedom." And Brigham says, "Don't do that anymore. You don't owe them anything. You know, just stop it." And so Green Flake, I think it's important to know, insisted on coming when Brigham died to personally dig his grave because he loved him so much.
Wow.
That was a service he wanted to render. Now, again, vicious racist, well, not in Green Flake's eyes.
Well, I think it's a reminder that people are complicated, right? And I think especially with the gospel, we want everybody to be perfect, especially our leaders. Yeah. We want them to, like, get the program, get the idea, and just always pick the right choice. And I think this really shows that he may have, you know, sometimes not done things that we would have liked him to do, but other times is really where we would like to see that. And I think I always quote President Holland's talk where he talks about God only has imperfect people to work with.
Yeah.
And
he's got to deal with it.
he makes it work, and so should we. And I quote that, I think, I don't know, probably every time I give a talk.
Yeah.
I love that because I think it's a reminder that, like, you think about Brigham Young and in relationship with ourselves, and you think, oh, I'm also an imperfect person, right?
Yeah.
And God's still working with me, and he worked with Brigham.
Yeah.
And he worked with Brigham Young and the whole church, and I love that.
Yeah.
I was at a presentation with a friend of mine on campus, and we were talking about the law of Moses. It was for, and so what do we do with all these, our presentation, what do we do with all these terrible laws and things we sometimes see in there? And one of the things that my friend and colleague Josh Sears pointed out, I said, but imagine in 200 years, somebody looks back on us.
Yeah.
And what are the things that we're doing? Like, say, maybe they're appalled by the fact that we watch violence for entertainment.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe they're appalled by the fact that we eat meat. Like, I don't know what he says. So maybe there are things that we think are just normal. They're going to say, why did you get the program? Why did you do that? Didn't you know better?
Yeah, I grew up when there were some big boxing matches and people would be all enthused about them. I'm not sure it's that big a deal anymore.
I don't think so.
But people used to watch and listen and I'd watch. And then it occurred to me one day, this is really a horrible thing. This is not much different than gladiatorial combats. I mean, you take two people there who are about as perfect physical specimens as you could ask for. They have endurance because they run, they have strength, all these sorts of things. And then they get in there and the object is to damage the other guy. That's barbaric. That's disgusting. We shouldn't be watching it for entertainment. And there may be other things today. There are some of our liberal abortion laws and so on. People say, how could you have thought that was right? We look back at people in slavery and think, how could you ever have thought that this was right? But some people who are otherwise seemingly decent did think it was right. To me, one of the great things about studying history is you ought to develop a sense of humility. At some point,
sure now,
at some point, the epiphany ought to come to you. Oh, look how stupid they were. Look how evil they were. They were blind to this. Look at the stupid hairstyles. Look at the ridiculous way they dress. Then think in 100 years, 200 years, people are going to say, look at that ridiculous hairstyle. Look at the way they dress. And they allowed this to happen and they did that. And we don't notice it because it's like the air that we breathe or the water we swim in. We just don't see it. Well, they didn't see it either.
Yeah.
And so I think it should teach humility, if nothing else.
I think so. And one of the things I love about, again, this video series is it can help us see a little bit also this notion that, well, maybe Brigham was less imperfect than sometimes given credit for.
Yes.
That our picture of him is this way. But actual Brigham was maybe a little bit different.
Yeah, when I hear people say, well, Brigham was a flawed man, and they almost always feel they have to say that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's trivial, because we all are, including you, you know. So was he flawed? Yeah, but sometimes I think that's a way of kind of smuggling in the notion that he was exceptionally flawed. He was an unusually bad man. That I will not grant. I don't think the evidence shows that. Did he have blind spots? Of course he did, and he would have recognized that. And he used to say about himself, yeah, my tongue is my most unruly member. I say things I shouldn't have said. But I think people knew that and took that into account, that he was flamboyant in the pulpit, and he would say powerful things, and which makes him quotable, but also a little uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah.
So I did remember the other one I was going to talk about, which was polygamy. Not that we have to go into that,
right.
But that's obviously going to come up. But
what
I did want to ask is, so we've talked about some of the difficult topics that might come up, but what do you think are some of the largest strengths you've really uncovered or learned that maybe you didn't know ahead of time doing this series?
Well, you know, I've been impressed, and I already kind of knew it, but I've seen more examples of it as we've gone along, with Brigham's absolute loyalty and devotion to Joseph Smith. And so there are people out there right now who are claiming that Brigham Young invented polygamy. He forged Section 132 and put it in Joseph's mouth. And we just published an article on that in Interpreter, which I think is pretty devastating to that, on stylistic, stylometric, computer statistical grounds and historical grounds and so on. But the thing is, it was inconceivable to me to begin with. And we have illustrations in the movie 6 Days in August, for example, where Brigham goes with some of the other apostles to Far West Missouri to lay the cornerstone and ordain a couple of apostles. Well, he did it because Joseph Smith said they would begin their mission to England from that point on such and such a date, which made sense when the saints were living in Missouri. But I think I at least would have rationalized and said, okay, by now, we're not in Missouri anymore. We're in Illinois. It's the wrong direction from England, and there's an extermination order out and all that. But for Brigham Young, no. We're going to do it. And you see that at various points in Brigham's life, that he is absolutely devoted to doing what Joseph Smith taught. And that's a really important principle for the succession crisis in 1844. One of my better interviews, I think, was with Ron Esplin, who's the big authority on the succession and all that kind of thing. And Ron made a point, really powerful point. He said, look, if you wanted to continue with the program of Joseph Smith in Nauvoo, there was really only one game in town. That was Brigham and the 12. Every other claimant to the leadership of the church wants to chuck one or other of the elements of what Joseph was teaching. And the two big ones at the time, by the end of his life, are completing the Nauvoo Temple and then sort of paradoxically abandoning it and going west. In a way, it doesn't make any sense. Well, Sidney Rigdon wasn't all that big into the temple, and he certainly didn't want to go west. He never did. He went back to Pennsylvania.
Before Herb Joseph died, even.
That's right. Yeah. So Brigham and the 12 were determined to do that because that's what Joseph taught. Now, it's not like he does it blindly. At one point, he just says, a lot of people think Brigham never claimed revelation. Oh, you can find references to it. He's very modest about it.
Yeah.
He said, you know, with all the pressure on us, I inquired of the Lord, should we finish the temple? And the answer was, yes, we should. And that's it. That's all he writes. But you know, one of the themes we tried to show in 6 Days in August is the importance of the temple for Brigham.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, the image I had of Brigham Young was great colonizer, organizer, man of action, practical guy. Not very spiritual.
Yeah.
Well, in the movie, we show him speaking in tongues more than once. And people asked, so you made that up? No, we did not.
That was
there in the historical record, including speaking in tongues to a pair of oxen, which actually happened. That opens the movie, and it's people like, oh, that's made up. No, it is not. But we wanted to show that. And the very first time Joseph saw speaking in tongues was Brigham speaking in tongues in his presence. But we also at the end show Brigham, the practical man of action. He should be out there outfitting wagons and getting supplies and organizing the pioneer companies. Well, he's doing that. He's also spending night and day in the temple performing ordinances. And then on the other end, when you get to the Salt Lake Valley, a few days into it, he goes out, plants his cane in the soil and says, here we will build the temple of our God. And so he was committed to that, absolutely. I've rebelled all my adult life against the idea that Brigham was just the practical man. I did a lesson. I used to be on the Gospel Doctrine Writing Committee. And I volunteered, I think, or I was assigned to do the lesson one year on Brigham Young. And I decided, you know, I'm sick of the Brigham Young colonizer thing. Everyone knows that. Let's do it. I'll mention it, but let's do something else. So I emphasized the building of the St. George Temple and his sermon there. If you understood the importance of this work, this house would be open every day of the week, 24 hours a day. Sometimes he said, I want the tongue of seven thunders to wake this people up. Trouble is, by the time it went through correlation and all the committees, it came back and it was Brigham Young, the colonizer. You know? So, oh well, I tried, but now I have a venue to try to make that point.
This is your chance. So I did have a question about, does the documentary go on site anywhere? Like, do you go to visit Brigham Young
yes.
home?
Yes.
Up in, this is a place,
the Heritage Park,
Or do you get to go down to St. George? I love visiting his houses.
Yeah, we haven't done St. George yet, but we will. That's definitely in the cards. We have we've been back to Nauvoo, to Kirtland, to upstate New York, to Winter Quarters, Mount Pisgah. And so what happens, we don't do the interviews there. They're typically local, you know, in the Church Historical Library or something like that. But I go out with the two co-hosts, our Brigham Young and our Emma Smith, and we sort of introduce the issues on site. And I'll tell you, filming is not as glamorous as some people may think. You do the scene again and again from different angles, sometimes in bitterly cold weather or incredibly hot, humid weather. We were back there one day in March, near Mendon, New York, filming there. And it suddenly dawned on me that Brigham Young had been baptized about 1,000 yards from where we were standing, about the same date of the year during a blizzard, just like we were. Only, this is a different species. I mean, he gets baptized in a river, and then he steps out, and they confirm him on the river's edge in wet clothing. I'm freezing to death out here in modern dry clothing. So, but we go to those sites to give a little flavor, to let people know where this happened, and so on. So, and, you know, then we'll say, well, we had an interview with so-and-so about just this issue, so let's cut to that. And so that's been fun to do. But we're going to go down to St. George, probably within the next few months. Eventually we'll even probably go out to Mountain Meadows. I mean, it's a dismal place. The worst blot on LDS history, in my opinion.
Sure.
But it has to be dealt with. We have to deal with that. And Brigham Young, again, comes off not only better, but much better than a lot of people have said. He absolutely did not order that. I mean, I've said, even if you assume that Brigham Young is evil, no one's ever accused Brigham of being stupid. And the Mountain Meadows Massacre was stupid, to say the least of it. It was not a good thing to happen, and he was horrified by it. But we will talk about that. So we go to these places and try to film on location, interior shots. I've been to Nauvoo 5 times in the last 12 months. That's more than I'd been in my entire lifetime previously. But we've been there in all seasons and, you know, filming in different houses and in front of the temple and in, well, anyway, just lots of places in the grove below the temple. And it's been fun to do that.
That is fun.
So
good.
Good. I think it will be really nice for the viewers, too, to really get a sense of place.
Yeah.
To be able to see those different locations. I've really enjoyed visiting different church history sites in Utah and in, you know, back east.
Yeah. It gives a sense of reality. You know, this isn't something that happened long ago, long, long ago in a faraway place or once upon a time in a distant galaxy. It happened in this room, you know, right here. So we filmed in Carthage Jail, and you know, you're in the room where it happened, right by the window from which Joseph fell. I mean, it's not even saying, man, I'm not appreciating this enough. This is astonishing to be here. I've heard about this all my life, and here I am, you know.
Thanks for sharing that. So we're out of time here. Any last thoughts on Brigham Young for our viewers?
Yeah, I would just say Brigham is a complex man. He's a very bright man, obviously very, very bright. I mean, not learned in our sense, but wow, what capacity he had. I remember reading a book by Irving Stone, who wrote books like The Agony and the Ecstasy and, you know, about Michelangelo and all that kind of thing. But I remember him making a comment in a book called Men to Match My Mountains about Brigham Young. And he said, you know, people have faulted Brigham Young because he became wealthy. He said he was so talented that he could almost not have become, not have not, well, whatever. He couldn't have avoided being wealthy because he was just so good. And he said, you know, if he had not been a Latter-day Saint, he could have succeeded almost anywhere in the country. He was that good. And he thought he was maybe the single most important person in the colonization of the American West. But that's back to Brigham Young, the colonizer. The other thing I want to say is he did it all for the kingdom. He really believed he was building the kingdom of God. And, you know, he could dig irrigation canals and plant poplar trees and things like that. But those weren't the end for him. They were the means. And the end was to get the saints over there, over to the Great Basin, set them up in communities, build temples, build Zion. And if you don't get that part of him, if you think he was just a really successful, practical man who was good at colonizing, you've missed out on the thing that made him work. It's what motivated him.
Yeah.
You don't understand him at all.
I think that, you know, sometimes he's been called American Moses, but like with that, Moses also wasn't just a practical guy who got Israel out of Egypt. He really is their spiritual leader. And you remember that for Brigham Young as well.
Well, and Lajine Caruth says, you know, I don't even like the term American Moses. It's accurate as far as it goes. She wants to call him an American Enoch. He was trying to build
Zion.
Trying
to build Zion.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks for being with us, Dan.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Conversations with Interpreter. To read the articles and scholarship discussed today, visit interpreterfoundation.org. Be sure to subscribe and share this episode with others who seek learning by study and by faith.